Questions? Questions? So, you know, we've got a non-quiz today. At the request of people in the other class, said they were studying too hard for their chemistry. So, I shouldn't have taken them seriously. Don't believe them in the future, huh?
So nobody can take
that credit. Yeah. It's a zero. It totally doesn't exist. Well, I won't say that. So the reason I'm handing it out at all is because I think that it's useful to kind of see what a question might look like on the exam. But I'm not going to collect them. I'm not going to grade them. You're kind of home free in that regard. But the lesson I should learn is don't trust them, huh?
Well, there was a test. We just came from it.
But you could have done this one just fine, huh? Okay. Fool me once. So, 2 times ago we had a boatload of equations, and last time we just had 2 equations. We were dealing with incompressible fluids, and water is usually treated as being incompressible, but you remember from one of the homework problems, it does compress a little bit if you put some extraordinary pressure under it. In fact, you can show that the concept of something that is incompressible is not possible. Everything has to be compressible to some extent. But roughly speaking, water and air, when we have velocities that are substantially less than the speed of sound, can be treated as being incompressible. In which case, if we have a pipe, the amount of stuff that goes in the pipe has to be the amount of stuff that goes out of the pipe. And that leads to this relationship between the fluid speed and the cross-sectional area of the pipe. And using energy conservation, we can relate the pressure and kind of the potential energy and the kinetic energy at one side of the pipe to the other side of the pipe. Incidentally, if you did want to apply Bernoulli's equation to compressible materials, it's not a big deal. You all remember enthalpy from your chemistry class, and basically you just end up replacing the pressure with the enthalpy of the gas. So I don't know, from before I rewrote down the stuff we had about buoyant forces because seemed to be a lot of confusion about those. Questions? So the next quiz isn't, I think, for quite a while when we get through temperature and kinetic theory. Calorimetry sort of quiz. Going. Let's take a look at some of these buoyancy questions since everyone liked them a lot last time. So here we've got a solid plastic ball, volume V. It's floating. That means the density of the plastic has to be less than the density of the water. What's the formula for the buoyant force on the ball? So B is the obvious answer, so it's clearly wrong. So that would be right if V were the volume that was displaced, but it's the volume of the ball. And clearly, the volume displaced is substantially less than the volume of the ball. On the other hand, we know that the object is being supported against gravity, so the buoyant force must be exactly countering gravity. Right? It must be mg. And for those of you who voted for A, that's fine, because the density times the volume is exactly the same thing as the mass of the plastic. So A and C are exactly the same thing. So in this case, when you have a floating object, the buoyant force has to be equal to the weight. Okay, so if I suspend the object underwater, what's the buoyant force? Like it this time. So now we do have exactly the circumstances. The volume of the object is the volume displaced. So we've got the density of the fluid, which is water, times the volume displaced, which is V times G. So B is the right answer. Seem to be missing one. Oh, here it is. Okay, good. So you've got an ice cube that's floating in a glass of water. If you wait long enough, the ice cube will melt. What happens to the water level? So when the ice melts, of course, it becomes water. And in terms of grams, it's going to be exactly as much as the water that it displaced, right? Because if it's floating, the mass of the ice cube times G times V has to be exactly equal to the buoyant force. So it is currently displacing the same mass of water that it's required to support it. When it becomes water, it'll just exactly fill that same space.
But ice expands.
Say again?
Ice expands. Water expands when it freezes, though. So the volume would be greater.
Yeah.
So.
Like when it melts, that means that the volume is going to decrease.
So ice contracts when it melts.
When it melts, yes. Yeah.
So when it melts, it'll exactly fill that bottom, that same cube, except it'll now have a level top. So let's say it the other way. So currently, the volume displaced is exactly enough to support the weight of the water, the weight of the ice. When the ice melts, it weighs exactly the same.
But it takes up a less amount of volume.
So it'll take up less volume, but the level will be exactly the same. Right? So we'll go from this situation to this situation, where this is now filled with water.
So then what happens?
So the ice contracts when it melts, and it'll exactly fill the spot up to water level.
Okay, so like the top bit of the ice also melts, the bit of the ice above the water also melts.
Yeah, the ice completely melts. The volume that is displaced is exactly what's required to support that mass. So this plays a role in global warming, right? We're worried about ice melting, but the floating ice doesn't matter, right? If it melts, it's going to take exactly the same volume. It's not going to contribute to sea level rise. So it's the ice that's not floating, that's sitting on top of land, that is particularly problematic. Okay, so we got these two cups, A and B. The water level is exactly the same in A and B. Clearly, there's less water in B because part of the stuff that is water in A is plastic in B. If we weigh these two glasses, which one weighs more? You see, mostly right answers. So it is C. The cups weigh exactly the same. So the difference in water is this amount of water that's displaced. And the weight of that water is exactly the same as the weight of the plastic ball. Because currently the weight of this water that's displaced is exactly equal to the weight of this ball because it's floating. There's no net force on it. The buoyant force up is exactly matching the weight of it down. Okay. Lots of non-intuitive buoyant force sorts of problems. Questions? So we've got kind of a funny situation for this last bit of this chapter. And if you look at the review summary, there are no equations that are listed. On the other hand, there are lots of equations in this final section. And basically what's going on is there are lots of special cases which they want to examine, but they don't think that many of them deserve kind of final placement. So the topics we want to talk about are topics that haven't come up before, really differences between kind of ideal fluids and real fluids. And probably the most important difference is viscosity. So viscosity is the thing that's different between this oil, which kind of seems thick, but you know that it has a lower density than water. Right? So here, this isn't literally water. It's got stuff in it so that you can see it. But you can see that this stuff is seemingly much more fluid. This is glycerin, and you can see it's kind of in between. That little bubble seems to be not moving as fast as it would in water. So viscosity is basically fluid friction. And you might remember when we talked about Bernoulli's equation, we said that it was a consequence of conservation of energy. So viscosity, since it's a non-conservative force, if it's present in large amounts, is going to mean that Bernoulli equation won't apply. So what exactly is viscosity? So we have friction when we have surfaces that are moving relative to each other. And the same thing is going to apply to a fluid. So if I have layers of fluid that have different speeds, then there's going to be friction as a result. And the amount of the frictional force, well, it depends on how big a piece we have, right? So if we're looking for the force on this sheet of paper, then the more the area, the more the force. The bigger the change in velocity with vertical distance, that is to say, we talk about the velocity gradient. The bigger the change in velocity, the bigger the force. And the fudge factor that goes in here is called the viscosity. Right, so this is change in velocity with distance. And this quantity by itself is sometimes called the velocity gradient. Okay. So what sort of role does viscosity play? Well, if we have water that's flowing through a pipe, and we're thinking about this sort of Bernoulli sort of equation, we've been thinking that the velocity is the same everywhere inside the pipe. But if viscosity is important, it turns out that the velocity has to be zero at the boundary, because that boundary isn't moving. And as we move away from the boundary, we're going to get larger velocities. And the velocity is kind of going to be biggest in the middle of the pipe. And this is all because of the frictional force, viscosity, that's present at the boundary of the pipe. So because of this frictional force, it's going to take some extra pressure in order to drive this fluid through this pipe. And there's a complex equation that describes the relationship between the flow that we're going to get and the corresponding pressure difference. So let me kind of set up all of the variables. So here we've got a pipe, and I'm going to have some pressure P1 here and some pressure P2 here, and generally speaking the flow is that way. So this pressure is going to have to be more on this end of the pipe, and the pipe is going to have some length L and some radius R. And the amount of fluid that's going to flow out of this pipe, so this is talking about the flow rate. So we're talking about cubic meters per second that are going to come out. That depends on all of these factors. So it depends on pi, the radius to the fourth, more on that in a second, the difference in pressure between the ends of the pipe, the viscosity, and the length of the pipe. And I guess there's an 8 in here too. So I think it's pretty clear that the longer the pipe, you would think you'd need more pressure difference in order to drive that same fluid through. If the viscosity is small, we're going to get an increased flow rate. That makes sense. Kind of the most important factor here, kind of biologically, is the very strong dependence on radius. So if you make a pretty small change in the radius, you're going to have a huge change in the flow rate. Or if, contrarywise, if the flow rate is fixed, if you change the radius by a little bit, it's going to take a huge pressure difference in order to drive that same flow rate. So people who have asthma have a problem that their bronchial tubes contract a little bit under certain circumstances, and the body requires a certain flow of oxygen, so it's going to keep the oxygen rate constant, and it's going to do that by drastically increasing the pressure output of the heart in order to drive the, the pressure output of the lungs, pressure difference between the inside and the outside of the lungs in order to keep that same oxygen flowing. So pretty small changes in the radius make huge differences in the flow rate if viscosity is the important factor. Okay. Well, kind of when do we apply this equation where we have viscosity being an important result and these sorts of equations where we're able to neglect viscosity? And I think a way of thinking about this to start is by comparing the force that you get of, say, objects that are falling under the force of gravity in a fluid. Right, so we're thinking about this ball that's falling. And what happens, what we see, of course, initially is some acceleration. But if you throw this down from a tall enough building, it will reach a constant velocity where the drag force of the fluid is just balancing by the force of gravity down. And there are a couple of ways we can estimate what that drag force is. If viscosity is important, then it turns out Stokes derived the following equation for the drag force, that this is 6 times the Is there a pi in here? Yeah, 6 pi times the viscosity times the radius times the velocity. And kind of the most important feature of this is that it just depends on the velocity to the first power. Okay. Now, another way of thinking about it, if we neglect velocity, is to think about what happens when I try and support, say, instead of having this thing fall continuously through the air, I can have the air support it. So kind of what's going on there? How could I calculate that supporting force? Well, if we were to look at the flow around this object, it would look kind of like that. And in particular, there would be one flow line that would stop right on the object, and we'd have stagnation. And if we apply Bernoulli to this sort of situation, we know that we're going to have a pressure difference at this point because we have zero velocity here, whereas we have a noticeable velocity far from the object. We're going to have a pressure difference there that is just this term, 1/2 rho v squared, where we're talking about the velocity way upstream. So this pressure difference that's just due to bringing the air to rest, sometimes called the dynamic pressure, kind of as opposed to the static pressure or just the weight of the air, which contribute to those sorts of terms. So we're going to have extra pressure on this side, but we're going to just have atmospheric pressure on that side. So roughly speaking, the force that should be on this object should depend on the cross-sectional area times this pressure. Now, what exact area should we use? Well, it's all kind of up for grabs, so we throw in a shape-dependent fudge factor that's called the drag coefficient. So what's important here, of course, is that this force depends on velocity squared. So if you plot something up that is proportional to the square, it looks like a parabola. And if you plot something up that goes linear, it looks like that. So for sure, for small enough velocities, this guy is going to win. It's going to have the more important force. Whereas for large velocities, the quadratic is going to win. So we can kind of calculate this magic brand, equal sort of point where the forces are going to be co-equal. Or we can just look at the ratio of these forces. So if we look at the ratio of the drag force to the Stokes' law force, what we've got is the area times 1/2 the density of the fluid times the velocity squared times the drag coefficient, which is dimensionless, and we've got 6 pi eta r v. And if we kind of cancel off that velocity, and remember that the area of our circle is going to go like pi r squared, if we just throw out all the dimensionless factors, what we have is r times the density times the velocity divided by the viscosity. So if this quantity is big, then the drag force is more important than the Stokes' law force. If this quantity is small, then the Stokes' law force is going to be the most important. And this quantity is called Reynolds number. And the way we've derived it, we've been thinking about particles that that are falling through a fluid, but a similar sort of calculation would apply to fluids that are flowing through a pipe. If the Reynolds number is small enough, and now for a pipe I'm going to use the diameter as opposed to the radius, if the Reynolds number is small enough, then the fluid flow will be laminar, which is to say non-turbulent. It'll have this kind of quadratic profile. On the other hand, if we have a big Reynolds number, then it turns out, first of all, the fluid flow won't be static. There will be little eddies that are going in it. The fluid flow will be much more complicated if we have big Reynolds number. So what defines the difference between big Reynolds number and small Reynolds number? Well, it kind of depends on the situation, whether we have pipes or whether we have free-flowing falling particles. But roughly speaking, for pipes, this division between turbulent flow at big Reynolds number and laminar flow at small Reynolds number is at a few thousand. So if we're interested in flow in blood vessels, for example, if the flow is slow enough, we're going to have laminar flow without turbulence. If the flow is fast enough, we're going to have turbulent flow, where the inertial forces, the dynamic pressure, are going to be more important than the viscous forces. And of course, it makes all the difference in the world. If we have eddies and things that are going on here, and this is a blood vessel, then it's going to be constantly being bombarded by moving parcels of fluid. So it's not a static situation. Whereas if we have smooth flow, then the forces on the blood vessels are going to be consistent, and you're not going to have the sort of constant impinging that you have with various sorts of eddies. And I take it it's no surprise that the capillary forces, capillaries where we have very slow velocities, are going to be laminar flow, and in the biggest arteries we're going to have turbulent flow. Okay, so Reynolds number is a way of distinguishing between where we have complicated turbulent flow and simple laminar flow. The details of how this process works is worth $1 million. So you may have heard of Nobel Prizes. They're called Clay Millennial Prizes for solving big problems. And one of the big problems that they will give you $1 million if you can solve is exactly how this transition between laminar flow and turbulent flow exists. So people have been working on this for a couple of centuries, and although lots is known, the exact details of how this transition occurs are not known, not currently known. They can be tabulated, so we can write how water flows through pipes, and civil engineers have those sorts of tables that list what the flow will be if you have a given pressure difference, so you can engineer your pipes just fine. But the exact mathematics of how this transition occurs is up for grabs. One of the outstanding unsolved problems in physics. Okay, yes?
What is the 2,000 between two?
So generally speaking, for lots of different situations, whether we're talking about falling objects, we can calculate a Reynolds number, and if the Reynolds number is big, then we're going to have turbulent flow. If the Reynolds number is small, we're not. The exact value that defines the difference between big and small is going to depend on the physical situation. So it turns out for flow through pipes, which is to say blood vessels, the transition between laminar flow and turbulent flow happens at, roughly speaking, a few thousand for Reynolds number. So it's not like that's a number that can be tabulated and put in your CRC. It's more like a ballpark estimate for whether you're going to guess that the flow is going to be turbulent or laminar. And it makes a big difference for the flow rate, right? So Generally speaking, if viscosity is important, the flow rates are going to be a lot slower than if we have turbulent flow where viscosity is unimportant. Questions? So we've all said lots of times that if you have something that's denser than a fluid, it's going to sink. If you have something that is less dense than the fluid, it's going to float. But I take it you've all seen steel float. It's a well-known trick to take a steel needle and float it on top of water. So how is it that that needle can float? Well, it's because of another non-ideal property of fluids. It's called surface tension. So another kind of standard example of this is we've always said that fluid surfaces are level, but you all know that if you look at water that's in a graduated cylinder, it's not level. It has a meniscus. So there has to be some force that is pulling the edges of this water level up. And that force is a tension, that is to say, it's trying to pull things together like the surface of a rubber balloon as opposed to make things expand. And it's a tension that we can calculate as a force per length. That is to say, if I had a wire that I was using to pull up a sheet of fluid, so here's the bulk of the fluid, and I'm pulling up this sheet of fluid, you can think about this kind of like a soap bubble, then this sheet of fluid is going to be pulling down. And so, of course, to move it up, I have to supply an equal and opposite force. The longer the length that I try and pull up, the bigger the force. And the force per length is a constant that's called the surface tension. Turns out there's a totally equivalent way of thinking about this in terms of energy. So instead of talking about a force per length, we can talk about the energy that's in this sheet. It takes energy to create that free surface. And numerically, it's exactly the same thing as this surface temperature, the surface tension. So you can either think of surface tension as an energy per area or a force per length. It all amounts to exactly the same thing. So you know that surface tension can easily be affected by contaminants that are in the fluid, right? So if you put dishwashing fluid in this stuff, the surface tension is going to be reduced and this meniscus will, as a result, flatten out. So it's kind of hard to have a useful value for the surface tension of any particular fluid because it depends on the fluid being particularly pure as opposed to having various contaminants on it. What determines kind of the shape of this meniscus? So if you've ever seen mercury sitting on a flat surface, it kind of forms a ball like that, where this contact angle inside the mercury is more than 90 degrees. On the other hand, water, not uncommonly, will bunch up like that. Similarly, if you put mercury in a tube, this meniscus goes the other way. So this contact angle between a solid surface and mercury, liquid surface and this solid surface, depends on the corresponding surface tensions. And it may not be obvious, but there are three surfaces that are involved, right? So here we have a fluid air, and here we have, say, glass, and there's a corresponding surface tension on this surface. Here we have water and air. There's a surface tension that's associated with that. And here we have water and glass. There's going to be a surface tension associated with that surface. And what's required, of course, is that the sum of the forces in the x direction better be zero. So if we call, let's give these things numbers, 1, 2, and 3. So this surface tension, call it gamma 1, 2. This surface tension is going to be gamma 2, 3. And this surface tension is going to be gamma 1, 3. If we look at the forces in the x direction, we have gamma 1, 2 that's pulling this way. We have gamma 1, 3 that's pulling that way. And we have gamma 2, 3 that's pulling at some angle, theta. So it must be that gamma 1, 2 is equal to gamma 1, 3 plus the x component of this one, cosine of theta, times gamma 2, 3.
Can you clean that up a little bit?
Yeah. So to me, the kind of surprising feature of this diagram is to think about the air as a fluid itself with a corresponding surface tension. So if I try and redraw this, so here's my, say, glass, which I'm calling 1, and here's the surface interface between air and water and glass. So here there's a surface, so there's a surface tension, which I'm calling gamma 1, 2. Here there's a surface, so there's a surface tension that I'm calling gamma 2, 3. And here there's a surface between, say, water and glass, and I'm calling that gamma 1, 3. And if there is a net force in the x direction, that interface will move. It can't jump off the page, so we don't care about the forces in the y direction, but it can slide along the glass. If we call this angle theta, then it has to be that the components of all of these things in the x direction have to add up to zero. So we get this equation then, which if we know the surface tensions for all the various fluids, we can calculate what the contact angle will be. Okay. Well, if we think about these forces getting smaller and smaller and smaller, kind of the best they can do is pull with exactly the same angle to have a contact angle of zero. Under these circumstances, at least the way I've drawn it, the surface tension on this side is still bigger than the combined pull of these guys. And so what'll happen if we have this sort of situation, namely if gamma 1, 2 is bigger than gamma 1, 3 plus gamma 2, 3, is we have the situation kind of like gasoline, right? So if you put any amount of gasoline on top of water, it spreads out as far as it can to an infinitely thin surface. If you look at globs of fat in your soup, they can sit as compact objects sitting in the water. Right? So the case of gasoline is that this thing is bigger than the combined value of those other two, and so as a result we have it stretching out arbitrarily. In the case of mercury, so what we have is this sort of situation where this angle is almost 180 degrees. What is the case is that this surface tension, the surface tension between air and glass, is much smaller than the other two surface tensions. So they have to nearly be equal and opposite in order to have an equilibrium situation. So we've talked about surface tensions, which are kind of like the rubber surface of a balloon that are trying to pull things together. It's possible to have the reverse situation. Things that, so with surface tension, it costs energy in order to create more surface. if we have the other sign, if we have something that's trying to expand, then what will happen, of course, is we'll have the situation of usually what we call miscible fluids. So you know that for some fluids, you put oil on top of water, for example, they don't mix. Right, so there's no desire to expand that area of surface. Whereas if you put, say, alcohol on top of this, turns out that the energy that's involved in the surface is the more you have, the less energy you have. It's a negative energy contribution. So these two want to produce as much surface area as possible, so they will mix. So the difference between immiscible liquids and miscible liquids just has to do with the surface tension that's at the boundary between those two materials. Whether it costs energy to create more surface or whether you get free energy by creating more surface. Okay. So what could we could work out the detailed equations for how this meniscus forms, but just kind of to give you a ballpark figure, the amount of the depression in a meniscus turns out to depend on the square root of the surface tension times the density of the fluid times g. So in the case of water, it's typically for comparable sorts of circumstances, it's on the order of a millimeter or so. Okay, so viscosity, friction in fluids, surface tension, an energy that's associated with the surface. Typically, more surface corresponds to more energy. The last topic we've got in this chapter has to do with concentration gradients. So you all know that the concentration of stuff inside of a cell is very different from the concentration outside of the cell, right? That's basically a definition of a living creature able to maintain that sort of concentration gradient between those two. Fick's law is a law that governs the diffusion of material that has different concentrations. And it works pretty much the same as what we were talking about for velocities. What we have is a concentration gradient. So look at the concentration, the change in concentration with, well, let's say y or any dimension. The bigger the concentration gradient, the more stuff is going to flow. So the change in concentration with position is going to lead to a flux of material. And there's a magic fudge factor called the diffusion constant that relates these two. So let me be kind of more specific. When I'm thinking about here's my material sitting in a beaker. It's concentrated, and then it kind of less concentrated up there. If I look at the flow of material through that cross-sectional area in terms of moles per second, so the moles per second divided by the cross-sectional area, that's what's exactly going to equal this diffusion constant times the change in concentration with altitude. Okay, so diffusion is the process that evens out the concentration of stuff. Inside a cell, the stuff isn't even, so we have to have some sort of pumps that are constantly working to pump the good stuff in and the bad stuff out in order to fight Fick's law, which is trying to equalize the concentrations of stuff. Okay. So with that background, let's take a look at some of the problems. So here we have kind of exactly the situation I was talking about. We have a ring in this case, that way we don't have an edge. We have a ring of wire that we dipped in plasma, and now we're pulling it out. And so we're going to get surfaces that are connecting that ring to the surface. And it says that it takes an extra vertical force of a couple of hundredths of a newton beyond the weight of the ring in order to do the lifting. And from this, we're supposed to calculate the surface tension of the blood. Now, there's one really tricky thing to think about in terms of surface tension of films. So let's think about this in terms of a soap bubble solution. So if we have a soap bubble solution, we've got the solution here, and we've got air on both sides. So we have two surfaces. So when we pull this ring out, there's going to be an inner cylindrical surface and an outer cylindrical surface, pretty much the same radius since the material is thin. So we're going to have twice the surface tension pulling this thing down. And so if here's a piece of the ring, goes around like this, here is the drapery of fluid that's being pulled out. We've got this surface tension down, this surface tension down. The whole length of this ring is being pulled down by that amount. So the force that's pushing this thing down is going to be the circumference of the ring times twice the surface tension, because there are two sheets, one on the inside, one on the outside. And they're telling us that this total force is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 2 newtons. And we know what the radius is. Might as well convert that to meters. So this is going to be 0.0175 meters. And so we're all set then to calculate the surface tension of this plasma. It's going to be the force divided by twice the circumference. And you can see that the units are going to be force per length, which is exactly the same thing as joules per square meter. Right? We can think about surface tension as a force or as an energy. And if we plug and chug, what we've got is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 2. Oops. Totally off. 1.6 10 to the minus 2. And we want to divide that by 4 and by pi and by 0.0175. And I don't get what I have on my notes. One more time. 1.6 10 to the minus 2. Divide it by 4, divide it by pi, and 0.0175. Yeah, there I do. So basically 7.3 times 10 to the minus 2 newtons per meter. Okay. So in the next point, we take two microscope slides and we put what is actually a pretty thick coating of glycerin, right? 1.5 millimeters is a whole lot of glycerin, right? It's a seeable amount of glycerin, not a small layer. And we're interested in the force that's required to pull them apart. So as we're shoving them apart, there's going to be a velocity difference, and they tell us that the top slide is moving at a speed that's 0.3 meters per second, and we're supposed to figure out what the corresponding force is. So for viscosity, the formula was the force per area is the viscosity times the change in velocity with altitude. So the area we're talking about is the cross-sectional area of these slides. Right, and this is 1 by 4 centimeters. We need the viscosity. The change in velocity is 0.3 meters per second. And I'm going to convert everything to centimeters just to be different. So 30 centimeters per second divided by an altitude difference that is 0.15 centimeters. So one of the reasons I decided to use CGS units for this problem is that, in fact, pretty commonly viscosity is not reported in MKS units, but it's reported in CGS units. So the general units of viscosity should be force per area per change in velocity per change in distance. So if we work out the units in MKS sorts of situation, this is going to be newtons per meter squared second. If we do the same thing in CGS units, we first of all have the CGS unit of force. So a newton, you remember, is a kilogram meter per second squared. A dyne, D-Y-N-E, is a gram centimeter per second squared. So viscosity in CGS units is going to be a dyne second per centimeter squared. And this is named for your basic famous dead physicist. It's called a poise. And even it is a little bit too big, so often hundreds of poise, centipoise, are often used to report viscosities. So in any case, the viscosity of glycerin is about 15 dyne seconds per centimeter squared, poise. Yes? So viscosities are things you could look up in your CRC, for example. They're characteristics of the material. They do depend noticeably on temperature. So typically, if you look at a CRC table, it would give you the viscosity at lots of different temperatures. So the viscosity of water changes by something like a factor of 2 between room temperature and boiling point. So noticeable changes with temperature, not huge changes in temperature, and very tabulatable. So for you will see values for surface tension for water, but they depend very carefully on the surface contamination. So it's not necessarily a useful number. And that's not true of the viscosities. They're, like density, they're very tabulatable. Okay, so we can plug in chug. We've got 1 centimeter times 4 centimeters for the contact area between our two slides. And we've got our 15 dyne seconds centimeter squared, and we have a change in velocity of 30 centimeters per second, 0.15 centimeters. So let's check out our units. Here we've got centimeters squared. From our viscosity, we've got force in dynes, seconds per centimeter squared. So those centimeters are going to go away. And then we've got 30 centimeters per second divided by centimeters. So those centimeters go away, those seconds go away. So the force we're going to get out is going to be in dynes. So we've got 1 times 4 times 15 times 30 divided by 15. So that turns out to be, a dyne is a pretty small force, 1.2 times 10 to the 4th dynes. And if you want, you can convert that back into newtons. It's 0.12 newtons. So here's our typical flow problem. We've got 50 meters of pipe that's carrying oil. They're telling us what the viscosity is in MKS units. They tell us what the flow rate is, and they tell us that atmospheric pressure is 1 atmosphere, and they want us to know the gauge pressure at the pipe input. So the pressure at the input has to be more than the pressure at the output in order to drive the fluid through. So at the output, we just have atmospheric pressure. At the input, we have an additional pressure. We have the gauge pressure plus absolute pressure to get the total pressure. And we've got our equation for the flow rate. So the flow rate in cubic meters per second, according to Percival's equation, is pi times the radius to the fourth times the pressure difference. Divided by 8 times the viscosity times the length. So, of course, the pressure difference is just the gauge pressure that we're supposed to calculate. And they tell us the radius, the viscosity, the length, and the flow rate. So we're all set to calculate that gauge pressure. So the gauge pressure is going to be the flow rate, which they tell us is 8.6 times 10 to the minus fifth. Remember that a cubic meter is 1,000 liters, so we're talking about about cubic centimeters per second. And then we've got our 8 times the viscosity times the length, 50 meters, all divided by pi times the radius. So we're using MKS units, so we want to diameter divided by 2 to the fourth. Okay, so we could crank that number out. So kind of a practical application of this calculation, instead of having oil flowing through a pipe, you have a solution that you're trying to get into a patient through a relatively thin meter. And in order to drive that fluid through the needle, it's going to take a certain amount of pressure. The fatter the needle, the less extra pressure we need. On the other hand, people don't like to have big needles stuck into them. They like to have small needles plugged into them. So here we're told that we want to get 500 cc's of solution into a patient in 30 minutes. And the needle length is about an inch, 2.5 centimeters. And typically how you do this sort of problem is you've got your bag of saline that goes to the needle that goes into the person's arm. So the pressure that we get by having this standing solution is what's going to drive the fluid through the very narrow needle. And we have exactly the same situation that we were describing. We've got atmospheric, we're supposed to assume that the pressure inside the vein is atmospheric pressure. It's probably 60 millimeters of mercury above atmospheric pressure, but we're ignoring that. We have some gauge pressure plus atmospheric pressure on this end of the needle in order to drive the material through. So we might as well use MKS units because they've given us a huge mix of possibilities. So the flow rate, that's the 500 cubic centimeters in 30 minutes. We want to convert this into MKS units. So we know that it takes 100 centimeters to make a meter, and we need to get rid of three of those powers because we've got cubic centimeters. And we know that there are, in 1 minute, there are 60 seconds. So we need to put all those things together to get the flow rate. Some are more interested in the flow rate than others. So this is 2.78 times 10 to the minus 7th cubic meters per second. And we know that the flow rate is given by that formula, right? Pi times r to the fourth times the pressure difference divided by 8 times the viscosity. The pressure difference is just given by this altitude difference between the hanging bag and the needle. And they tell us that this is 1 meter. And we know that the pressure you get when you go down a height in fluid is just given by rho gh. So this pressure difference is just the density of water, which is 1,000, times g times the height difference, which is 1 meter. You can look up viscosity in a table that's earlier in the book, and the so this is 71. Well, this is 69. Okay. So the viscosity of water is 10 to the minus 3 in metric units. So if we rearrange this equation, let me call this flow rate r just so I don't have to write the number. So all of this stuff, r is a bad choice. Let me call it q. So we want to rearrange this equation to give us the radius. So I want to put everything else on the other side of the equation. So I've got 8 times this flow rate times the viscosity divided by pi times the change in pressure. That's equal to radius to the fourth. So I need to take the fourth root of all of this. That's taking the square root twice in order to get the radius. Okay, so we know all of the numbers on this side of the equation. So we can plug and chug through this, and what we get is 2.1 times 10 to the minus 4th meters, which is 0.2 millimeters. Pretty reasonable size for a needle.
What is Q?
So Q is the flow rate. Why is it on this sign?
Never mind. Okay, never mind.
We're good?
Yeah.
So we calculated this flow rate from the problem of the 500 cc's that we needed to get in 30 minutes. Mostly unit conversion and to get to metric units. So here we have an application of Stokes' law. They tell us that when an oil drop is dropped through air, the force on it, the Stokes' law force on it, is 3 times 10 to the minus 13th newtons. And they tell us what the speed is, and we're supposed to figure out what the viscosity of air is. So the Stokes' law formula, you can see this is a case where there are lots of formulas. The Stokes' law formula was 6 times the radius times the viscosity times the velocity. And there's a pi in there too. That's equal to the force. So we know what the force is. It's this 3 times 10 to the minus 13th. We're told what the velocity is, 4.5 times 10 to the minus 4th. We're told what the radius is, 2.5 times 10 to the minus 6th. So it's a pretty small drop, comparable to a cell. And we can just plug and chug through to get what the viscosity of air. Incidentally, historically, I don't know, for 10 years or so, a lot of people, the viscosity of air was mismeasured in the 1930s, which led to all sorts of problems. So this is 75. So you can plug and chug all that through, and what I get is that the viscosity of air is 1.44 times 10 to the minus 3 Newton seconds per meter squared. Okay.
What is J?
So this is 6. Oh, okay. So this is the formula for Stokes' law. So we started out talking about Stokes' law in terms of having macroscopic objects fall through air, but biologically one of the most important properties of Stokes' law is to think about proteins that are being centrifuged out under very high g-forces because they are centripetally accelerated. I think you have a homework problem that's dealing with that situation. Questions? Okay, let's call it quits. Yes. Quiz? Is that what you're going to ask for?
Yes.
Oh, thank you.
You too.